And now, because you can't beat a great writer to kick off your Sunday afternoon, John Banville, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
John, I'm still recovering from your new book, The Singularity. It's quite a trip, I have to say. I'm not even going to attempt to describe it, and you'll hate this, but how would you describe it?
Well, I'm still recovering from it as well.
I can imagine.
Took a long time. Took about 6
I
years.
Only had to read it.
Took
six
about
years.
6 years to write. I hope it's entertaining. It's meant to be. The purpose of art, one of the purposes of art, is to delight the reader or the viewer or the listener. It is playful. It takes place in a sort of alternative universe that's very like our universe. But then I always think of this universe as alternative. I feel this is not our place. You know, we should be somewhere else. So
what
I
do
always
you mean?
Feel.
What do you mean?
I always feel strange in this world, don't you?
I thought it was just me, though.
It's everybody. It's just because we've been around for a while, we've got used to it.
Yeah?
It is a very, very strange place.
So do you think if we stood back and looked at it objectively that none of this really makes sense? No?
Well, this is one of the purposes of art, is to help the reader or the listener or the viewer to look at the world in a new way, but in an old way, to look at it with childish eyes. In childhood, everything is new, everything is strange, everything is still clothed in mystery. And that's how, you know, when you encounter a great work of art, it shows you the strangeness of the world, the beauty of the world and the ugliness of the world, but mainly its strangeness. I mean, it's such a mysterious place. I always give the example, look at the sky.
Yeah.
You look up and you're looking into eternity, infinity. And then, you know, it's a clear day, and suddenly all this cannon smoke comes swirling up from the horizon. And each one of those clouds, those big, soft, satiny clouds, each one of them has the power of a hydrogen bomb in it. A very, very strange world.
Do you manage to look at it afresh every day with the eyes of a child yourself?
I certainly try to, yes. Yeah. I mean, this is why I write. I think the reason I write is to try to account for the world to myself.
So you famously kind of not hate all your own books, but you never feel you've got there, like you're embarrassed by them because they weren't right. Are you happy with this one now?
Oh, no. I'm happy with the crime books because they're good, well-crafted work. You know, I give them all my craftsmanship and I'm quite proud of them. But the other ones like this, all I see are the faults and the flaws and the failures. And that's as it should be.
Yeah.
If I was satisfied, I'd give up writing.
Okay. So the thing is, you have kind of intimated that this could be your last one of the literary books, but it feels like you feel you might have to go again to get it right.
It'll certainly be the last of this kind. As I say, 5-6 years to write a book, I just couldn't take that on again. I'll keep writing my crime books and I'll do some other things, but I couldn't do this again. It's too much hard work. It's grinding labour day after day after day after day. There are great joys in it, but mostly it's just hard, hard work. I'm too old for it now.
So why do you torment yourself like this?
That is a very good question. I think every artist asks himself and herself, why am I doing this? At least 3 times a week I look up from my desk and I say, I'm supposed to be a grown-up person. And here I am sitting day after day elaborating these transcendent lies. Why am I doing it?
I gather your joy to be around when you're in the middle of a big one like this, are you?
I must be a torment for my family. And I think that having a writer in the house must be a very eerie experience. Because I go into my workroom, I shut the door, and there's total silence for hour after hour after hour. I always think of my workroom as the black hole, you know, not even light escapes from it. It must be very eerie. And then, you know, I stumble out at the end of the day looking for someone to kill because I've had such a horrible day. And then I have my first glass of wine and then I learn to pretend to be human again.
Good God. Right. The thing is, you say you'll do other things. And on one hand, I can see your misery at this trade, right? But on the other hand, like, what else are you going to do with yourself?
It's not misery, it's hard work.
Yeah.
There's a difference. there are great joys in it every now and then. Every once a week, you know, I write a sentence and I think that's as near to being right as I can get it. Now, that's a great joy.
Yeah.
Because the sentence is, I've said this many times, the sentence is our greatest invention as a species. There have been civilizations that could do without the wheel, but they had to have the sentence or there wouldn't have been a civilization. And it's a great privilege to me to have spent my life working with this basic, profound invention of human beings.
Yeah. You did feel like you were having fun reading this with the sentences. You know, I read the first few pages and I thought, he's just showing off here. He's just showing off with words and language and everything. This is going to get tiresome. But you know, it you settle into it then and it's enjoyable. But you really, the brio, would we say, of the language, you clearly like put a lot into it this time, and little in jokes. And I felt there were jokes with yourself that I wasn't even getting as I read.
Oh, there are lots of jokes. I mean, there are so many references to my own books and to other books, to other writers whom I've admired over the years. That was great fun. It's also great fun to invent an alternative universe. I mean, in this book, as in a previous one of mine, motor cars run on salt water and the Dutch have reconquered New York.
Yeah.
This is great fun.
So in a way, it is science fiction / dystopian future kind of stuff.
It's not dystopian. I mean, it's just the same as our world. I don't believe in dystopias. The world is as it is. You know, it's a horrible place and it's an absolutely glorious place.
Yeah. Do you go into a kind of a dream stage when you write, kind of a fugue stage? Yeah,
I think that, and I'm sure there are other people, probably sports people, have the same experience of sinking down to a level of concentration where it does seem a kind of trance state. Time becomes different. Time moves at an entirely different pace when you're at that level of concentration. You know, 2 or 3 hours can pass by and it would seem to me like a minute.
Yeah.
And sometimes the other way around. So time becomes completely elastic when you're at that level. But you have to be at that level of concentration to do good work.
You're talking about flow, as it's called. Yeah.
Oh.
Are you familiar with the notion of flow?
I don't think I could say that. Work like that doesn't flow. It's...
No, but you could be in a state of flow when time becomes elastic and you kind of
like, oh yes, that's
things
true.
Start happening almost. Does it start happening almost automatically for you then at times?
Well,
you
every
don't
know time
where it's coming through you, like
every morning when I sit down, I look at the page and I think, I don't know how to do this. I just do not know how to do this. I don't know how I did it yesterday or the day before. What am I going to do? I get into a panic, and then I put down a few words and then I push them around and then I add a few more words and. After an hour or two, I realise that I'm lost. I've sunk past myself. I'm no longer myself. The person who's writing at that stage is not me. I don't know who he is, but it's not me.
Okay, it's probably good he has that room to go into then, is it? I would imagine. You mentioned there the world, a lovely place and a terrible place. And you deal in this book again, I think, with, you know, the crooked timber that is people. Not nice people, a lot of them.
Well, do you know many nice people?
But do we not? You see, this is the thing. Do we not live in a world now where we're all... Is everybody not pretending to be really nice? And, you know, they're all sending each other good wishes all the time and WhatsApp and all this, and everybody is feeling everyone's pain and we're all lovely.
Is that right? Goodness, I didn't notice. The world doesn't change. People don't change. We are as we are. We are as we were when we were in the caves. I always say, my friend, philosopher John Gray, and I agreed that the only real progress we've made is the invention of the flush lavatory and dentistry.
And do you think there are good people and bad people? Is evil a thing in people?
No, if I had my way, I would banish the word evil and the word good from the dictionary. I would replace it with the word circumstance. In certain circumstances, we will be good, we will do our best. If circumstances turn bad, we will turn bad along with them.
Yeah.
We've seen throughout history that perfectly ordinary, no such thing as ordinary people, perfectly sound, decent people will do almost anything. There is no depth of evil that we won't sink to, given the circumstances. I remember years ago, I fell in the street, I tripped over something. I wasn't hurt, but, you know, within seconds, there were about 8 people around me, helping me up, you know, giving me recommendations, offering me cups of tea. And I remember thinking, in different circumstances, these people would be herding me into a cattle truck going east. It's all to do with circumstance.
What do you think? So if you didn't have the room to go into and let the black heart thrive in there, do you think you're capable of anything? Like, are you capable of killing somebody?
Oh, yes, of course.
Yeah?
And then, you know, if I didn't have art, God knows what I'd be. If you look at the history of the 20th century, some of the greatest monsters were failed artists. I have a Jewish friend who says that if only they let Hitler into that painting academy in Linz when he was young, we wouldn't have had the Second World War.
Yeah.
And it's probably true.
Have you had murderous thoughts?
Of course.
Yeah?
Haven't you?
Not that I'm willing to admit to here. critics or people in your life or what?
Oh, no, I don't. I don't read reviews. I don't read anything about myself. But, you know, we've all come up against people who want to thwart us, usually for no reason. I can't think of anybody offhand that I want to kill at the moment.
At the moment, okay.
But, you know, I'm old and mellowed now. And I'm lucky. I mean, I've had a wonderful life. I'm rather sad at the moment. Next month is the first anniversary of my wife's death. She died last November. But on her last night, she said to me, I'm not afraid, I've had a glorious life. And so have I. I have 2 wonderful sons, I have 2 wonderful grandchildren, I have 2 wonderful daughters, I have my daughter's mother, Patricia. I'm extremely fortunate.
Yeah. You don't seem like a joyful kind of person.
Well, what would joy look like? You know, sort of going about casting flowers, dancing through meadows and so on. Joy is ordinary.
Yeah. Has the grief been tough?
Very tough.
Yeah.
And it's interesting too. Bereavement is a very interesting state. It's not at all what I expected. It's kind of like, it's like an unending hangover. A really bad unending hangover. But
so,
there are moments.
So you wake up each morning and you go, oh my God, here it is again, is it?
The mornings are difficult. Mornings and twilight. Those are the 2 hardest times of day. But, you know, the murk clears every now and then and I get glimpses of the sunny uplands that were the past and that will be the future. Life is always worth living. As my wife used to say, certainly beats the alternative.
Yeah. So, are you feeling old?
No, I don't. I mean,
you said you're old and mellow, though.
Oh, I am old, but as Oscar Wilde said, the tragedy of old age is that we're not old. I'm actually about 37.
Yeah.
And I will continue to be about 37. I don't feel old at all. The young, and I was the same myself when I was young, the young regard the old as a sort of different species. But, you know, we're not a different species.
Yeah.
We're just slightly more wrinkled and slightly more decrepit. But we're the same people that we were when we were young. And, you know, I have wonderful friends. You know, I go out to dinner with Neil Jordan the other night. I see my friend Killian Murphy. I go out with Harry Crosby. Harry always cheers me up. You know, Harry's probably my best friend at the moment. Another writer, by the way. I hope you've read his book.
I've read some of his work, and actually, it's not bad.
It's more than not bad. It's very, very good. He's a natural writer, a natural storyteller.
Are you encouraging him in this new path?
I don't need to encourage him. If you're a real writer, you don't need encouragement. And one of the nice things about it is that all the proceeds from sales go to Father Peter McVerry's charity. So, you know, buy the book, help the charity. I should be plugging my own book, of course.
You should, but it's implicit, I think, in the whole conversation. You do think books are less important in the culture now?
Well, they seem to be, but, you know, I blame the mobile phone for that. But I heard recently one of these Silicon Valley, you know, teenage billionaires, and he was saying something very sensible. He said, you know, at the turn of the 19th century, everybody was talking about electrification. You know, what kind of electrification have you got in your house? What kind of bombs have you got? What kind of... And he said, now nobody thinks about electricity. He said, in 10 or 20 years' time, phones will just be another part of our lives, and we'll stop regarding them as being miraculous. We'll be used to them. We'll be fed up with them. Human beings get fed up with things.
I'm watching this thing about Elon Musk, and he's saying, look, we'll all be cyborgs in the near future. Now, taken to its extreme, he's saying that basically they'll be able to take people's consciousness and put it onto a computer and we live forever, implanted in something else. But one point he made was, he said, we're cyborgs already. The phone is part of us now.
Oh, yes. Well, the phone. And the phone is also listening to us. I mean, the phone is a surveillance device.
Do you reckon, yeah?
Oh, absolutely. If you're sitting and talking to your friends about some commodity, within 5 minutes, an ad will come up for that commodity. They're definitely listening to us. I don't think I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but they are listening. Of course they're listening.
So back to the books. You feel they're on the wane, yeah?
No, I don't. Not at all. The book is the most wonderful artifact. It always will be. It's far more beautiful than the phone. And, you know, iPhones are beautiful objects. It was very clever to put glass in them instead of plastic. That was a brilliant idea. Gives them that weight and that solidity. But the book is still the most beautiful thing.
Yeah.
And look how much stuff you can pack into it.
Yeah. You packed a huge lot into this one. One of the things that is in there is ridiculous men, isn't it? Ridiculous men and their egos and their petty grudges and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, some years ago I did a thing in the University of Lyon in France, and it was a talk before lunch. And then there was a lunch in an upstairs room, 13 men. And I thought, this is my idea of hell. An eternity of sitting here with 13 men. If one woman had walked into the room, everything would have changed.
Why are women more interesting?
I just find them more interesting. I find them more entertaining, more fascinating, more puzzling. Everything I've ever learned in my life, beginning with my mother, it's from my sister, my girlfriends, my wife, my lovers. Anything I've learned, I got from them.
Yeah, so what's gone wrong with men so that we're so dull?
We never get over the loss of the mother.
Really?
At the age of 4 or 5, suddenly we're saying, Mummy, where have you gone? Where have you gone? Women don't have the same attitude to their fathers. They're attached to their fathers and so on, but not that same sense of loss, I think.
No, the women leave the father ruthlessly at a certain point, don't they?
We can't figure out, where has she gone? You know, at my age, I'm still, I know that at some basic level, I'm thinking, where did she go?
And so are we around just looking for mammy as well then, like in the women in our lives and stuff?
Of course.
And do the women know this?
Oh, of course they do.
And they're okay with that, yeah?
I don't know. I can't speak for them.
Yeah.
But I know that I must be searching for something in my mother, in the women. Lots of other things as well, you know.
Yes. Yes.
Not just the lost mother.
Yeah.
Women are entertaining. They're funny. Much more of a sense of humour than men have. And much less sense of their dignity and their place in the world. Women can laugh at themselves.
Yeah.
And laugh at men. I had a girlfriend when I was very young, a teenager. She's a wonderful woman. She said to me one day, John, you really love me, don't you? I said, oh, yes, darling, I do. She said, see my mother over there? She's the shape of an American fridge. She said, I'd be like that one day. You still love me then? just wonderful lesson for an adolescent, you know.
Do you take yourself seriously? Can you laugh at yourself?
Oh, of course I can. I'm sitting here laughing at myself, aren't I?
Yeah. Listen, we'll go back to the book a little bit, because there's a thing I want to ask you about. And as you say, there are old characters and old themes in this book. It's almost like a romp through your greatest hits in a way. You're like Phil Collins, you know, on his last tour.
Thank you, Brendan.
Hits. Right? So the godly interference effect, which is interesting, right? So as I understand it, without getting into the parallel universes, but it's a kind of a version of that an experiment by nature of being observed is changed. So is it that the more we know about the world and how it works, the more the world is degrading around them, yeah?
Yes, that's the godly interference effect.
Yeah.
It's called science, of course. I mean, I made it all up.
Yeah, I knew that.
But, I know, but quantum theory is far more puzzling and mysterious than anything I could make up. I mean, do you know about entanglement?
Go on.
In quantum theory, if you have two particles, blue and a red, and they're conjoined, you separate them. You bring the red one to the other side of the universe. The other side of the universe. You change the colour to blue. Instantaneously, the red one here will change its colour. Instantaneously. Now, how does that happen? But it does happen. It's used in the science that's behind our phones and laptops. We don't understand it. One of the great quantum scientists, Richard Feynman, said, if anybody tells you that he understands quantum theory, he's lying, because nobody understands it. And I wish I could live long enough, because someday a new Einstein will come along and say, ah, I think I see a way through this. Now, it won't be the same.
That's why you want to live longer, to find out what's the ultimate answer in quantum theory.
Not how
the world is going to turn out, not how civilization is going to turn out, all of that too.
I have a fair idea.
Have you? Yeah, go on. Are you optimistic?
Optimism or pessimism, these are two other words I would banish. I mean,
okay, what's your fair idea of how it's all going to turn out?
Well, it's not doing too well at the moment, but human ingenuity is amazing. I mean, we're facing a world that's going on fire. But I heard a science program the other day, and there was a person on saying that he had a plan to fill the atmosphere with tiny microscopic mirrors that would reflect light back and cool the planet. Human ingenuity is extraordinary. So I suspect the human ingenuity will save us.
Yeah.
I hope so. For the sake of my children, my children's children, I hope so.
Do you know Desmond Morris at all?
No.
You remember who he was, yeah. You know he's living in Ireland now. I spoke to him a few weeks ago.
He
came here after his wife died. He obviously has been observing everything for nearly 100 years now. And he's of the same mind that human ingenuity has always kind of managed to move us on, and that it will do the same now. What's your read on the world right now, though? It seems the whole thing seems quite crazy to a lot of us. That it's as if in the last few years, it's as if there was a John Banville character writing the world as it slowly went off kilter more and more,
well,
isn't it?
I think that the world, people forget, the young forget, and the world, I think, is now having one of its periodic bouts of dallying with fascism. That's extremely dangerous. I mean, there's a far-right government in Sweden. Did you think that in your lifetime there'd be a far-right government in Sweden?
No.
Look at Italy, look at Hungary. France would probably have a far-right government. But, you know, maybe the far-right will find a way through. I don't know. I'm not a political pundit. God forbid. If I were let loose on politics, imagine what would happen to the world.
Yeah, you see, I think in a lot of ways, though, the political pundits are too close to it to see. Sometimes it takes the artist to look at the big picture and say, call some kind of eternal truth about it.
Well, the artist is constantly returning to a state of childhood. The great French 19th century poet Charles Baudelaire said that genius, small g, artistic genius, consists of the ability to summon up childhood at will. And I think this is true. Childhood is the raw material of the artist. We said earlier, when you're in childhood, everything, you're seeing everything for the first time, and it still has all its mystery intact. So that's what art, if it gives anything, that's what it gives, is keeps bringing us back to looking at things afresh.
Yeah,
or as we did when we were young.
Yeah, the singularities, there is quite a lot of kind of nostalgia and casting back to the past and everything. Are you at that point now? Do you get that way as you get older? Do you get more nostalgic for childhood?
I was nostalgic when I was 3 years old. you know, how wonderful things were when I was two. The past fascinates me. It fascinates me as to when does the past become the past? You know, when does yesterday become the past? And you see this particularly in old movies. If you go to see a movie that's 10 years old, you're laughing at the awful clothes and the silly out-of-date clothes that people are wearing and the out-of-date slang and so on. Look at it in 20 years' time and it will be a classic. Nobody now laughs at Humphrey Bogart's waistline of his trousers somewhere up around his nipples, you know. He doesn't want to do it with his hands. And he wears his hat indoors always. Nobody notices that because it's become a classic. At what point did the silly movie become a classic? And it's the same, at what point does the past become the past?
I'm looking back now in the early parts of this interview and I'm thinking that was golden period in the interview. So we're winding down now. Listen, I don't know if this will be the last time you come in to me to talk about your latest book, but John, I really hope it's not. I feel you're getting an itch already. Is there something growing in you? Well, I presume you can't escape, can you?
There is a problem that, you know, what do I do with my day? It's like being on a holiday. You know, I hate being on holiday. I remember getting a postcard from Brian Friel. He was in France and he said, here for 2 weeks, one with good behaviour. And that's exactly how I feel. And now I don't know what to do. I think, what do other people do with their days? How do they fill them? So I'll obviously have to find something to do, and it will probably be a book.
Yeah.
But it won't be this kind of book.
Okay, yeah. Man does not live on lunch with Harry Crosby alone, as good as that is. Yeah.
It does pass the time, but no.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, John, thank you for coming in today. And The Singularities is out now, and it's an extraordinary read. And it's published by, will you pronounce the name of the publisher?
Knopf.
Okay. John Banville, thank you very much. Break.
Email brendan@rte.ie.